Welcome to Cyberside Chats from Epic, a global legal services provider. Hosted by Jarek Beeson, Chief Information Security Officer at Epic, Cyberside Chats is where professionals come to hear CISO and industry leader insights on the latest news and trends for cybersecurity and privacy in the legal industry.
Welcome to Epic Cyberside Chat, where we are excited to be developing content for and by the legal, privacy, cyber insurance industries, and really anything that relates to legal professionals. Now, there's a lot of cybersecurity content in the media, but we believe there's a gap when it comes to the legal industry specifically. We are seeking to address that with our show. My name is Jarek Beeson, and I'm a Senior Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer at Epic, and I will be your host. This is episode 3, and we're just now getting into our groove. We have a show planned for you and a topic planned for you that I truly believe every executive in every organization should be aware of. We're going to be talking about cyber insurance. What is it? What are some of the myths about it? What is the future of cyber insurance? Our guest today is Jacob Ingerslev from The Hartford. Jacob is the head of cyber risk at The Hartford. He joined The Hartford through Navigators Group in February 2017 and is responsible for the cyber risk and technology E&O product suite, underwriting strategy, and incident response solutions, as well as the leader of the enterprise cyber risk practice. Jacob started his 20-year insurance career in the insurance market, underwriting technology and life science risks, and has held leadership positions with CNA Financial Corporation and the Chubb Corporation in both Europe and the U.S. Mr. Ingerslev holds a B.S. and Master's of Law degree from, I might not pronounce this right, Aarhus University in Denmark. I don't know if I got that right, Jacob, but welcome to the show.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me. And that was spot on. Danish is not the easiest language for English-speaking folks, so I appreciate the effort. I've been in the industry about 20 years, and that's probably as long as cyber insurance has existed. But I got into it a little bit later than that. But certainly, the past 10 years, I've been involved with cyber insurance, both working in Europe and the U.S. And I've spent about a third of my career in Copenhagen, a third in London, and now the most recent third here in the U.S. So it's certainly a very exciting area of insurance. It's extremely dynamic in its nature, insuring cyber risk.
I think we have the perfect guest for our show. I think Jacob just combined insurance and exciting in the same sentence. This is definitely the guy we need to be talking to. So for those that aren't familiar with our show, we like to start off with an article, and that article is related to the topic, and we have a guest that is an expert in that topic. And the article that we've chosen is from Forbes. They released it in January this year. It's titled, The Next 5 Years of Cyber Insurance, Predictions Through 2025. Now, for me, this was a really interesting read. You know, the business of cyber insurance, it's booming. It's expected to grow year over year 20 to 30% for the next 5 years. And then the continued adoption of technology across virtually every sector is all but necessary for growth within almost every organization. Some might even say it's essential for survival in this highly digital era. But with this technological advancement comes more cyber risk. And I have to imagine that the underwriters see this. And the article alludes to a looming major cyber insurance catastrophe, specifically regarding significant losses on the part of the insurer due to constant changing calculations in the risk models. So, Jacob, I have a question for you. Do you think that we are going to start seeing a greater demand for demonstrations of due diligence before the cyber insurers pay out?
Yeah, it's a very interesting article. And in fact, we discussed this exact article in our monthly enterprise cyber team meeting last month. You know, predicting the cyber market or, you know, new attacks and what's coming our way. I mean, it would be great if we could say we know roughly what's going to happen in the next 5 years. I think cyber risk has told us already many times so far that we can't expect that the history is going to repeat itself. It's an interesting area for that reason. As I said, very dynamic in its nature. So there are a few different things happening, and these aren't new developments. I think insurers have been concerned about these two aspects of cyber for as long as it's existed as a product we or as a risk we insure. So when we think about the models that insurers use, they achieve or try to achieve two things. So in a given year, we use one model to figure out what amount of losses, what's the frequency and severity of loss we expect to see. in a given year. And in every line of insurance, you look back. You take a historic view of the past and say, you know, this is what we assume will happen in the next 12 months with certain adjustments depending on changes in the risk environment. And so insurers look at two aspects of loss. Attritional loss, so those are the individual one-off losses that you expect to impact some of your policyholders in a given year. And then we look at catastrophe loss, which is events that might impact a lot of insureds or policyholders at the same go. And there are kind of changes in both areas, and that's driving some concerns for the industry. So first off, the attritional loss, so the individual losses that happen to policyholders, that's gone up both in frequency and severity. And it's driven substantially by ransomware. That's something that we see in the news all the time, obviously. I think everyone probably knows what a ransomware attack is by now. But it's something that's continued to change, again, back to the dynamic nature of cyber risk. So, but in a nutshell, what's happening is attacks have become more sophisticated, and that's caused the demands to go up, meaning the severity is going up as well. So in the essence, losses are becoming more expensive. And so when you see that happening, it has an impact on the catastrophe view as well, because the catastrophe view is made up of what we look at as the individual loss impact and then combine it into, well, how many policyholders might be affected by this one event. There are concerns happening on both sides. And what we're seeing right now is in the immediate sort of short term, the industry is trying to adjust for that increase in frequency and severity. It's not as much about increased due diligence before insurers pay out. It's more about increased due diligence before insurers take on risk to begin with. To qualify for cyber insurance, you now have to have certain controls. That's always been the case to some extent, but it's become a lot more extensive in the way that insurers select risk and they look at what's the security posture of an individual company. So insurers are increasingly using tools, cyber risk assessment tools, to figure out what does a given organization's posture look like from the outside. So you can use security scoring or rating tools for that purpose, where you can see, you know, which open ports they have, which services are running, and which critical vulnerabilities might be present as based on the CVE framework. So that's becoming a really sort of key component of the risk selection process. And then obviously losses are going up. Like in any other line of business, that means prices are going to go up. And that's what we can expect for the foreseeable future and what's already been happening. And when we look at the catastrophe side, if we go back a handful of years in the industry, it was mainly data breach that was driving loss in the industry and impacting cyber insurance policies. So what we have seen over the past 5 years is a transition much more into ransomware loss, which is really everyone's risk. It can happen to any size of organization, any industry sector or public sector entity can experience ransomware. The risk has increased for that reason. What we then need to look at is, you know, how does that accumulate into the total catastrophe exposure that we're concerned with? And in that also comes into play some of these attacks we've seen as of late, supply chain attacks or attacks exploiting common vulnerabilities in widely used technology. So all that is sort of fueling catastrophe loss estimates. 5 years ago, the industry was mostly paying out for data breach losses. The margins were pretty good. And that had been the case since the early days of cyber insurance in the early 2000s. And with the ransomware epidemic that we've been seeing for 2 to 3 years now, just sort of increasing year over year, those margins have to some extent been wiped out. What you had before was some feeling that you had money in the bank from individual underwriting years being quite profitable. And then you had that money available to pay out if there was a big event. Since that's no longer the case, you're now having to make sure you're pricing adequately for the catastrophe event, in addition to the losses you continue to see sort of throughout a year from individual attacks against your insureds. So that's really a summary of what's going on in the cyber insurance market as a result of the change in cyber threat.
So it sounds like you guys are aware, and I'm pretty sure the pocketbook is aware as well, and as you were kind of alluded to with the margin, that something needs to be done differently, and you're pretty much taking the approach that organizations are taking to manage their supply chain, and you're going to do deeper or more thorough assessments using various scorecards and risk modeling techniques to determine the premiums so that your high-risk companies don't necessarily impact your margins in the same way that maybe they did over the past year. But to me, it sounds like there's still a minor gap in that it's a point in time. You know, I'll use an analogy. My wife and I, we just got a new car insurance, and they sent us a little dongle that we can plug into our car, and they gave us an app we could download. And it monitors things like how fast are we going. It looked at, did we use our phone while we were driving? And the better drivers we were, the better rate we got. And we had to keep it on for a month. And then after that month, we were locked in at our rate for the rest of the year. And that brings me to, you know, a state and time assessment. A company may look good in January, but they could deploy a new product, they can make a change, and then in March and April, their risk posture completely change, and you're still locked in. Is that something that you guys have thought about?
Yeah, I mean, you're pointing to something that is a huge challenge in assessing cyber risk when you decide or not to provide insurance coverage for those events, because a typical renewal cycle is once a year. So we only really engage with a customer or policyholder and their agent or insurance broker, which is what's typically involved in the business-to-business insurance process, once a year. So we may observe what happens throughout the year using some of these tools I mentioned, where we can observe the perimeter of a given organization. And so we can see changes, but we may not be able to do a whole lot about it between those two, you know, sort of 12-month points, which is the renewal of the policy or the first inception of the policy. So there are some changes on the way in the industry where both in order for insurers to protect their own balance sheet and, you know, hopefully ensure that their customers maintain a good security posture throughout the year, but also as a service to policyholders, there is initiative underway in the industry to provide monitoring and alerts throughout the policy cycle. It's still early days, and not everyone on the policyholder side is that sort of open to having such alerts come throughout the policy period or having conversations during the policy period. They have to rely to some extent on the coverage being in place based on the risk assessment that was done when they first got the coverage or when they last renewed the coverage. So those are some of the implications and some of the challenges we face. But I do think there's a role for insurers that provide cyber insurance to play in terms of acting on a risk control basis throughout the policy period if policyholders are receptive to receiving such services, meaning alerts that now we see this new vulnerability, which could be, you know, that suite of vulnerabilities that were announced and with associated patches for the MS Exchange server issue that became public recently. So you could see that sort of service being provided midterm and alerting customers. But most of the time, they would be alerted through other channels and through the tech service provider that may have a new set of vulnerabilities that they want their customers to patch.
I like the approach that you guys are taking. And I can tell you, you know, sitting in the CISO's chair, one of the problems or one of the challenges that we have is articulating return on investment for all of our security investment. At best, we can talk about cost avoidance and, you know, reputational protections. But if I could articulate every time we do this well, or if we do this activity, we can reduce our cyber premium by X. You don't necessarily have to wait until next year. We can wait until our monthly or our quarterly review. That would be huge. You guys win because you have better protected organizations, and security professionals win because we have more support for some of our initiatives as well. Just a thought, something to put out there, like a variable type of rate.
Yeah. I think your example with your car insurance is that's sort of the ideal world from an insurer's perspective. If we had a plug-in into an organization's network that allowed us to see everything, we would be much better informed. But that's probably extending it a little bit too far, and potentially that adds an extra security concern for a prospective policyholder.
That is a perfect segue into my next set of questions, actually. About a couple of weeks ago, a ransomware operator alluded to specifically targeting companies with cyber insurance because presumably they're more likely to pay out. They also alluded to targeting cyber insurance providers so that they could get the list of companies with cyber insurance. And then just over the weekend, a cyber insurance provider announced that it was hit by a ransomware attack. How do you think this will play out into the future of cyber insurance moving forward?
Yeah, it is an issue. It's not necessarily a completely new issue. The presence of insurance coverage has been added as a tactic in the suite of tactics deployed by threat actors. And they will, from time to time, point to the fact that they were able to exfiltrate data from the victim organization that included the evidence of an insurance policy and maybe ask for exactly that amount. You know, it's just another tactic, just like we've seen threat actors go to the extent of destructing backups that might help a victim organization recover versus having to pay up the ransom demand. Other tactics have been stealing sensitive data before deploying ransomware, again, as an extra leverage to make the victim pay up. And so to me, it's another item in that list of items and tactics that they deploy. And there have been some discussions about, you know, is one feeding the other, meaning is insurance feeding the ransomware epidemic? I think ransomware be around regardless. And I think, unfortunately, at times, the insurance policy may play into the tactics of the ransomware threat actors. But I think most of the time, they were going to deploy these attacks anyway. And so it's just once they're in, they happen to stumble upon this. Equally, attacks against insurance carriers that have a significant presence in the cyber insurance market. This recent one wasn't the first one, and it likely won't be the last one. But obviously, we hope that threat actors haven't gotten hold of extensive policy lists or information about which insurance companies provide insurance to which organizations. Because to some extent, certainly at the large end of the scale when it comes to organizations, they buy cyber insurance from a lot of different insurance carriers because they have to build substantial limits, sometimes upwards of $1 billion. And so no single carrier puts out that much limit. It's usually, you know, up to 10 million per insurance carrier. So if you get insurance information from one carrier that you might have attacked, it could affect other carriers who also provide insurance to those same companies. So it's certainly something that the industry doesn't take lightly, but we will have to wait and see what comes of this attack and if that's truly the case, but obviously it's concerning.
You know, I didn't think about the industry connection component. You know, I can tell you from a cybersecurity perspective, when we see another cybersecurity company or another organization get hit, we feel for them and, you know, we want to lend a hand and help. And if they're in our industry, we automatically look inwardly just to make sure that the way it happened, we're still good and we're okay. But I can't imagine what it's like to wonder, is their attack going to impact us? Because now some of that information has kind of been commingled and put together. That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to look at it from the perspective of if you have that information, you still have to compromise a company. And while many of these attacks are happening, there still are many organizations out there that have good security, which prevents these attacks from happening in the first place, or they have good recovery, which allows them to not have to pay the ransom. And that's really key here. So it's, again, I look at it as it's one extra tool in the toolbox of threat actors. But if you're able to prevent or recover from a successful backup, then that doesn't come into play anyway. And I think these days, the penetration rates of cyber insurance are pretty substantial. And so I think threat actors probably assume that there might be coverage when they start their attack against a given victim organization.
Fascinating. Well, I think this is a good stopping point to move to our next round, the Ask the CISO round. What did you bring to the table?
Yeah, so, you know, really in light of all of what we already talked about, obviously, we as insurers are really, really interested in understanding how policyholders or prospective policyholders are reacting and adapting to that ransomware threat that's going on, you know, really, really an epidemic at this stage. And so, you know, from your perspective, in your role as a CISO, in dealing with your own organization's exposure, what changes have you had to make as a result of ransomware threat changes? Or even, you know, as we've seen lately, supply chain attacks, which can be very difficult to defend against?
So that's an interesting question, because there are some very specific things for the ransomware threat itself, things like immutable backups, so that if I have a backup that's connected, the bad actor can't write over it. One of the things that people always bring up is if you have backups, then you're okay. Well, none of those backups are connected to the same environment that they've already compromised. Right. So there are some unique things like that. But generally speaking, ransomware operators haven't really changed the playbook. They're still following the same tactics as every major attack in history. They start with a period of reconnaissance to select and understand their potential target. You know, we'll see things like an uptick in probes or scans against our network or our applications. And then they go and they craft a specific package or exploit or phishing email. Then they launch that email, they launch that attack, usually a phishing email. But we are seeing an increase in compromised internet-facing systems. And then after they successfully install malware, they try to establish some level of persistence so that they have multiple paths back in if they happen to get kicked out. Around the same time, the adversary is doing things like trying to get admin level access. They will look to spread to more systems. You know, all of this is before they ever attempt to steal data or encrypt it. You know, before ransomware, all of this was done to steal data. Now it's steal data and encrypt it. And if we can prevent or detect the attack at any one of these stages, we've successfully staved off a ransomware attack. So to answer your question directly, we spend a lot of time making sure our ability to mitigate these specific capabilities are as mature as possible on-premise and in the cloud. Now, as it relates to suppliers, the supply chain risk, it's not new either. You know, we've been dealing with this for years. For those that aren't familiar, here's a short history lesson. Target was breached in 2013, and those in the security community know that this was actually done because their HVAC vendor was breached. The attacker compromised the HVAC vendor, and then they used that trusted connection to jump into the Target network, much like we're seeing in the SolarWinds attacks and some of these others that are out there. Here's a little bit more information. ISO 27001, which is widely viewed as the de facto standard for global security frameworks. Some may argue NIST, but it actually came out 7 years later, 853 specifically. Either way, the supplier risk management controls, they were in there way back then. And all that to say is this risk vector has been out there for 20 years easily. What's different is the widespread impact we are seeing from these attacks. So in that regards, we haven't adapted per se. We already had a third-party risk program before all these attacks surfaced, and we still do. But we have ramped up some of our continuous monitoring using some of our tools like BitSight. And that's kind of our approach and our vision of it. I haven't had to adapt as much as I've had to answer this question over and over in questionnaires and things along those lines when I get them from customers.
Yeah, it's, you know, we think about many of these issues in our underwriting process when we select which risks to insure versus which ones not to insure. So it's good to hear. I mean, it's really a similar thought process, and you're absolutely right. Supply chain attacks have been around for a while, and they will continue to be. And it's making certainly underwriting more challenging, but it is something you can get to if you ask the right questions and use the right tools. And that's what we're attempting to do in that process. So you're a sizable organization, and obviously you're the CISO, so you have, and you know, that function in your company, and a team to help protect the company's network and monitor for events and so on and so forth. If you're a small business and you probably don't have such a function in-house, or it may be a one-man team or one-woman team, what would you say to a small business if they can't do everything and they can't have this sort of robust in-house security function? What would be like a handful of preventative or recovery measures that would be the most important from your perspective?
Sure. So I would always say try to align with the framework. Even if you can't do every control in that framework will give you a good baseline to go off of. But if I had to choose a handful of those controls, the first one would be asset management, and then vulnerability mitigation, two-factor authentication, and then a strong detection and response capability. And if I start with asset management, it's a lot harder to do in larger organizations, but in a smaller organization, you have a better chance of wrapping your arms and your hands around everything that you have. And it's imperative because you cannot protect what you don't know about. And you can't make risk-informed decisions without understanding the context of those assets. The better you manage your assets and the software on them, the more equipped you're going to be to ensure the controls that you want are on them. For example, you'll apply one set of controls to a system with sensitive data on it than you may to a system that doesn't have sensitive data on it. You need that level of context. Vulnerability mitigation is also high on my list. And a lot of people say vulnerability management, they say vulnerability remediation, but I believe mitigation is the goal because you're really trying to manage risk. And the ideal mitigation is patching, of course, patching or configuration, whatever is necessary to close that vulnerability. But there are instances where you can't do that. There are compatibility issues, there's timing issues, there's just a number of reasons why sometimes you can't simply just patch a vulnerability. But the whole goal of patch management is to mitigate the risk of somebody exploiting that vulnerability. And patching is not always the only way you can do that. So if you are aware of the vulnerability, you're aware of what can happen if someone exploits it, and you mitigate it at one of the many phases of that mitigation, I think you're doing enough, especially as a small organization. And then there is the detection, two-factor authentication. It is by far the number one control to mitigate large amount of attacks that are out there. Credential stuffing attacks are happening all the time. And for those that aren't familiar with credential stuffing and password spraying, which are the more popular ways, your organization does not have to be compromised for the passwords in your organization to be compromised, because so many people are reusing passwords. And if they steal the password from your fantasy football, site, and you use that same password in your environment, you can go ahead and consider your environment compromised as well. But using things like two-factor authentication, they mitigate those risks. And then beyond two-factor authentication, just detection and response. You got to turn on logging. You got to have a capability to see when something bad is happening in your environment. There's absolutely no way that you can prevent every single bad thing from happening, but it's imperative that you detect it as early as possible, and you have the right processes and protocols and even technology in place to remediate and recover as fast as possible.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with all of those items and all of those measures. And what we're seeing, we have the benefit as an insurance carrier, but also as the industry. The industry has the benefit of seeing from a macro level what goes on, based on forensics reports and the claims we're getting in, working with incident response firms. And two-factor authentication absolutely is key on this, user account compromise involved with vast majority of attacks. And if you can prevent that, that reduces your risk tremendously. So I think that's certainly important. And obviously being able to recover from a protected backup, which you mentioned early on. Those two things, probably one and two from our perspective.
Yeah, my organization hears this all the time. Any customers that I talk to, they hear this all the time. Hackers don't hack in, they log in. At the end of the day, they're trying to get to a credential. And the better we protect those credentials, the better we protect our organization. Well, Jacob, you are a wealth of knowledge. This was an awesome experience. I'm honored that you chose to spend your time on our show. I have one last question for you, and this is, for our audience. If they are interested in getting cyber insurance, what should they do?
Well, I think, first of all, cyber insurance is more valuable now than it's ever been. Just the ransomware epidemic, again, is really what's driving that. And so definitely worth exploring if an organization isn't already purchasing cyber insurance coverage, definitely worth exploring the benefits of it. And that's not just the coverage itself. Insurance carriers increasingly provide a number of different services, and most of them come with the policy. They don't cost anything. Obviously, the incident response services come with the policy. So that's incident response specialist companies that come in and help you if you have been the victim of an attack. But also on the preventative side, you know, insurers will provide security rating reports that help organizations identify critical vulnerabilities. Some of them have remediation services through third-party partners that they offer. So those are some of the benefits, but it's key that you're prepared when you seek out your cyber coverage because of what we talked about earlier in the podcast, which is insurers will expect certain things and they will be able to see if you have issues by using these cyber security rating applications, you know, BitSight's One, Security Scorecard. Those are some of the tools that insurers increasingly use. And so if they do find stuff in those reports that fall amongst those, you know, more commonly exploited vulnerabilities for ransomware delivery or other types of attacks like business email compromise fraud, then an organization should be prepared to fix those issues before insurance coverage is offered, or it may become extremely expensive, or they may not be able to buy as much limit as if they did fix those issues. So that's sort of what I would say about the benefits of coverage, but also what you need to do as an organization to get the coverage nowadays.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'd add one more thing from my consulting experience. Most of these cyber insurers, they have a Rolodex full of people that you can call quickly. You don't have to make decisions. You don't have to figure out who it is. They have forensics experts. They have the right accounting firms. They have everyone that you may need at your disposal, and they can get them there quicker than you can if you haven't already planned for it. Jacob, thank you for your time. Very much so appreciate it. And you're welcome back anytime.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. If you have any questions or ideas from today's show, share them with us by emailing cyberside@epicglobal.com. Don't forget to follow us on socials. You can find us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram by searching for Epic Global. Until next time, stay cyber smart.